Welcome to Ankh Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. In today's episode, we invited experts from across oncology specialties to discuss the long-term effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, the onset of which occurred 5 years ago. Our guests shared how the pandemic's lingering effects continue to shape patient care. We heard from Ramez N. Iskander, MD, Rachel N. Grisham, MD, Benjamin Herzberg, MD, Kelly McCann, MD, PhD, and Gregory Roloff, MD.
I think the biggest impact of COVID was on staff. So in order to be able to run clinical trials appropriately, you have to have the staff that's required not only to take care of the patients on trial, but also to activate clinical trials and to manage them. I think it's very difficult for people to really understand the dramatic team of individuals it takes to run a clinical trial program. During COVID, there was a lot of attrition. Many people either left their jobs, transitioned to other jobs that were completely remote in nature. And so there was a real depletion of staff in clinical trial organizations. And it took time to rebuild. You know, thankfully, many institutions have been able to rebuild. And that's critical because when you rebuild, you staff up appropriately, you can open and activate trials in an efficient manner, and you can offer them near patients. And so thankfully right now we're seeing a recovery from that, but there's still laggard effects, meaning we're still seeing some degree of that legacy, that halo effect from the staffing changes that happen. But, you know, I'm very optimistic. Our institution is rebuilt in a dramatic way, and we're in a great position right now. I feel like that's occurring at many institutions.
I really feel like telemedicine does provide an opportunity for us to be able to provide a similar standard of care across diverse geographic regions, and a potential opportunity to try to bring the research that has been predominantly centralized at academic institutions to a larger expanse of our population through opportunities to, in some clinical trials, ship drug to local providers and then be able to centralize toxicity assessment through those with expertise in that particular type of cancer, and just many more ways for us to try to bring a quality of care across the country.
During COVID-19, we definitely had massive disruption to clinical research efforts and research efforts across the cancer center. In some ways, that made us more lean and more productive once some of the worst part of that went away. But in other respects, I would say, like, you know, we are still feeling the effects years later of having to shut down and compress our portfolio so deeply. That takes like many years to work its way out through the system, and we're just starting to get there. I'm also worried now in a similar way about the cuts being contemplated at the NIH and other places, to that those could affect clinical research in a similar way to the ways that COVID did, us having to compress our portfolios, shut down, lose people that contribute to clinical research. This unrelated to clinical trials, I would say, you know, we've definitely on an observational level seen patients who have long-term scarring or other abnormalities in their lungs from severe COVID-19 later presenting with lung cancers. Now, I have to say it's not, you know, patients present with lung cancer for all sorts of reasons, and this is just an observation, not a controlled or clinical trial. And it's very hard to tell presenting with a lung cancer from didn't go for a screening test during COVID and so presents with a lung cancer later, right? There could just be a delaying effect, and we can't rule that out. That said, there's lots of tumors which are caused by inflammation in an organ. Hepatocellular carcinoma caused by chronic hepatitis, right? GI cancers caused by chronic inflammatory bowel disease. This is a well-known concept. And we see people who have evidence of chronic inflammation in their lungs after COVID, and then we see cancers in those individuals. So, you know, it's again, very hard to tell. Is this just a shift because of shifting clinical patterns? Is this a new phenomenon? It'll take some research to figure that out. But as of where we stand today in 2025, we're definitely seeing these type of cancers show up in patients who had severe COVID-19. And the sequelae of prior COVID-19 can make them harder and more difficult to treat and require a really multidisciplinary approach to do it well.
Right now for telemedicine, Medicare is still covering that. And so other insurance companies follow. But the rules are supposed to change in April, and I don't know how they're going to change, which is very scary. So when we first started with COVID, I think telemedicine was absolutely essential. Now it's become something that we're all much more used to, and that is more convenient on some levels, especially for the patient. You know, if I have a patient who is hours away, then yes, we're going to do a telemedicine visit. But ultimately, the in-person visit shouldn't be completely lost either. I get so much more information from an in-person visit than I do from a telemedicine visit. I've had patients who, when we were doing video visits, and 6 months later, they come in for an in-person visit, they come in stooped over from pain, which they had hidden from me on the telemedicine visit. I also think that in-person is better because I'm a visual person, and so I usually take notes for them, and I draw for them, and so I can hand them that sheet of paper at the end of the visit. And in general, people are more engaged with you when you're in person. I've done chemotherapy teaching by video visit. I've done it in person. And people retain more from an in-person visit than they did from that video visit. Maybe because they have time to think about it before they get there because they've driven that way. And then they have time to process the visit after they've left because they're driving away. You know, there's this it's much more... there's much more retention that way. But I do have patients who are infusing in different locations and we're only doing video visits. I think if you trust the nurses and the people, the support staff who are at those faraway places to be doing the job that you would be doing if that person were with you in your own infusion center, then it can be totally safe to do. You just have to expand your network out much further. Yeah, COVID-19 changed a lot of things. Now I have patients who only will do video visits. We'll see how that changes when the Medicare rules change. For my patients who are housebound for whatever reason, it's especially important to have the telehealth remain a viable option. I have patients who have agoraphobia or are bedbound, and the conversation is about enrolling on hospice, and telemedicine is the kindest thing to do and an essential part of their care, whereas they wouldn't get the same care if they had to drive in and see me because they're not able to. So I hope that we're able to keep doing telehealth, but that people also appreciate that in-person visit is especially valuable as well. And yet we still sometimes can't figure it out. I mean, it's pretty common that a telehealth visit falls through because somebody can't figure out the equipment, or a power outage happens, or the connection is not great. And so you kind of lose that visit. But it's now become an essential part of medicine that I hope we can keep doing for specific cases. Patients are more willing to be vulnerable with you when you're alone in the room in person than they are with telehealth. Often if you're on telehealth, there's people wandering around in the background, or maybe their spouse is sitting there where their spouse wouldn't necessarily be there if you were coming in person because they can't take off work. So it could go either way, really, with how much they're willing to share. If someone is really hurting, just reaching out and touching their forearm or something might unleash the floodgates, and then they're going to be more vulnerable with you and they're going to share what's really going on with them. Or you notice tears in their eyes in person, but you wouldn't necessarily notice that over Zoom because we don't have that good, that kind of definition there. So I could see it go either way, but I would think that probably people are more vulnerable when they're in person. They're more willing to talk to you about things that they wouldn't talk to you about if they were on just a screen.
It makes us wonder, especially about what sometimes might be a reflexive decision to start patients on immunosuppressive therapy earlier and earlier when monitoring might be a reasonably acceptable alternative. The patients who I think actually were kind of hit pretty hard with COVID as a leukemia doctor were those with CLL. And when CLL patients are going to transition from a stage of being clinically monitored, which is typically the name of the game up front, to being treated,
the decision to initiate treatment is one that will vary patient to patient based on what their counts look like, what their symptom experience is. And, you know, a lot of times if patients are not feeling great and there might be a reasonable indication to start, we will start. And this often includes therapies that are quite immunosuppressive. Not to say that patients who have CLL have a normal antibody producing B cell compartment to begin with. We know they don't. But I had to think long and hard over the last couple of years, specifically with my CLL patients, about committing them to a therapy that I knew was going to severely immunosuppress them. And by and large, as we know, probably not allow them to meaningfully respond to COVID vaccines, because a lot of the therapies that we're using are leading to a functional B cell depletion. In order to take out the CLL, we lose normal B cells as well. And so it leaves them quite vulnerable to COVID and to other upper respiratory illnesses that, you know, go around seasonally, and probably renders them, you know, not overly responsive to our vaccines that would typically allow them protection. It's very convenient for them and for us to work out some sort of partnership, ideally with a local doctor, to have them you know, be seen if something were to arise, but to check in virtually, you know, as much as we can, and not neglect the importance of inpatient visits and certain testing that needs to be done at critical time points. But I've been a big fan of it. I think it's great for patients. Clearly, if there's some benefit to doing the physical exam, or there's a new issue that's arising, we, you know, the patient should definitely be seen. And so it's not a substitution for an inpatient visit, but it's a great supplement. And especially for individuals who have reached a point of inertia in their treatment and are doing well, and there's not too much rocking of the boat. Perhaps they're a little bit older. Perhaps they live a distance from the tertiary care center. It's a wonderful option that allows them to, you know, not have their lives uprooted and overly medicalized by, you know, what might otherwise be a really quick visit in and out, and leaving them wondering, huh, could that have been a video visit all along? So I'm a fan of telemedicine. I look for opportunities to use it when I can. And I'm curious to see, I think it's here to stay, but I'm curious to see how we can be smarter with this tool in the future.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.